got long stories,
short stories,
art stories,
sports stories,
books about the wild, wild west. Yeehaw!
We got fairy tales.
Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. Those of us who take the road through War Memorial Park on Jonesboro have, over the past months, viewed with various emotions from acute dismay, horror, bewilderment, and astonishment as trees and houses were demolished, bulldozers created a moonscape of destruction, out of which grew a building within a park that was revealed as the new Children's Library, the latest addition to the Central Arkansas Library System. Bobby Roberts, Cal's director, is my guest, and answered some of my many questions, such as, where did the idea come from?
It was something that's been on my mind for 10 years, probably. And it comes from two or three different points of view. One of them being that there are really a lot of good programs for children in the Central Arkansas area. But a lot of times, poor children and children that really need to get to those programs don't have the wherewithal to do it. So we became interested in what if we built a children's library where we could do some of that programming and do a wider variety of programming than what we're doing now, which is concentrating on reading, as you would expect the library to do, that would be a benefit to children, especially children that need enrichment and they don't get it. So that was one piece of it. And the other one was to see if over time we could connect children that we see in the library to other programs in the city so they could go. So if somebody's interested in the Civil War, for example, and there's a good Civil War program going somewhere, we'd like to see if we could get that child over there to do that. That'll take more time. But we have 2.5 million people come in and out of the doors of the public library a year, and about 40% of them are either children or parents and their children. So we have a big network, and we think we can serve it better and get them to the right places. So that was sort of the genesis of it.
Well, how do you get them? Do you intend, or have you already begun establishing some kind of library bus service to get some of the children who don't have parents who can drive them hither and yon?
We haven't, and you hit on a big issue of transportation. I think one of the problems that children have is they cannot get to the programs. Their parents cannot get them there. They're working. They don't have time to do it. Our bus system is good, but it's not as extensive as it should be. We are not going to do that right now, but I think before too many months, we will probably get a bus where we can actually go pick children up. Now, we have a lot of schools that come in, and we schedule a lot of programs with schools, and they come in. We've been working with the churches to get those groups in. So there are other means to get them there. But transportation is probably the biggest issue that we face, I think, in getting children to any of the programs that we have. The second one is money.
Like they have these buses that go for handicapped people to everywhere. I see them all around the city, picking people up and taking them to their classes or to whatever doctor's appointments there are. And if you had something like that with Central Arkansas Library Service on it, that this was driven by people who knew the age group they were talking about, like a school bus driver who would have more awareness of what was going on in the bus than a regular transit might be.
Well, that's probably true. And, we have a lot of children that come in after school. Mm-hmm. We have 14 other branches. And so we have a lot of children in the buildings, and I think we will look at some point at trying to bring all those children over to the new children's library because we can just do more programming in that building than we could do in any one branch.
And this new library would be big enough for the number of children you're envisaging?
It's about a 30,000 square foot facility. Has a lot of things in it that we just didn't have. It has a kitchen in it. Now, food is an issue. I think two children have been, you've been in school all day and suddenly you're loose, and so you need to run off some energy, which they can do at the library, but you also need to have a bite to eat. We also have a greenhouse, planting bed. So as we get our programs in place, we'll be able to take children, show them, how to germinate seeds, grow plants. We can prepare that food for them and have people learn the whole food cycle.
What you're saying tells me you're going to need a slightly different librarians.
We do. We've hired, in fact, our first environmental instructor, for lack of a better term, because mm-hmm. the library itself sits on about 6 acres of ground, and it's intentionally designed to look like the map of Arkansas. So you can show children that these are trees that grow in the Ozark Mountains, and these are trees that grow in the Delta, and this is why one won't grow in this place, and so forth. So we have an environmental person. We have a theater in the building, so we can do children's theaters, and if they want to act, they can be actors. If they want to make scenery, they can. So we had to hire somebody to do that. So we'll be doing a lot of things that we've never done before.
So what age group? From what to what?
Well, we started out really wanting to deal with middle school, but the truth is we're going to start from early on when children can get out with their parents up through teen years. And teenagers can certainly use that library, but we have a better facility for them in the main library, which is really geared up for teens. So we're trying to keep those two separated, yeah. Although the libraries are havens for a lot of children who just need a quiet place to go or a safe place to go where they know they're able to read, or in the case of the teens, we have a game center, and they can do joint projects on computers, and it actually has a kind of a little malt shop feel in it, so they can get Cokes and food, mm-hmm. and so forth. And I think it's just a good place for people to go, and it's a safe place for them.
Yeah. And I just wondered how you had set in motion the works that get this sort of thing done. How did you find the site? How did you convince the people to give the money to fund it? Who did you go to, apart from the architect, which we'll get to in a minute, the earth moving? How did they come in, and when did they come in, and who worked with them, and was it the architect in charge all the time? All these hundreds of things you were working on, Bobby. Did you think you had bitten off more than you could chew?
Well, you know, sometimes I think that. You just blindly run into these things, yes. I think. But we've done a lot of projects before, and they look complicated, and they are, and I always marvel at you actually can – people can start out with an idea. You can talk to people about it, sell it to them. Get the money to do the project, which was a taxpayer-funded project, and then you can bring all the skills together to make it work, locate the land, and do all the things you say. We're lucky, I think, in Central Arkansas. We have great architects and contractors and realtors, and so we're able to do that. But when we started looking for the land, we had a couple of sort of rules in mind. One is we wanted to be south of 630. We thought that was important because that's the socioeconomic part of the town that's in distress, and it needs public projects in it. And we thought that would be a good place to put it, and symbolically it would be important to put it south of 630. As you know, 630 is a dividing line in the city, so that was one decision we made. The second one was we wanted to be close to War Memorial Park because there are a lot of amenities there that everyone in the city can use. But again, if you're south of 630, it's hard to get over there. And there's still some work that needs to be done, I think, to make that work better. So we wanted to be where we could take advantage of the zoo and the golf course and the tennis courts and the fitness center and UAMS and all of those things. So we were looking sort of in that area. The third part of it was the most difficult one, as you say, is anytime you're going to build something like that, you're going to displace people. You can't help but do that. So we probably spent more time looking for the land and talking to people than we did actually building the building. It cost us a little bit of money, but in a $12 million project, it was a very small amount of money.
Yeah.
So we just tried to be sensitive to it, understanding you still have to displace people. And it's a beautiful piece of property for what we were wanting to do.
And it is, as you say. But how did you find an architect who could match your dreaming to get you to work out the dynamics? Because you said it had to be south of 630. How did you decide which way it was going to face?
You know, that's where architects can work together with the owners, and good architects can talk you through the process. We had done several projects with Polk Stanley, who was the firm we hired to do that, and that's the second project we'd done with Reese Rowland, and two very different projects. The first one was the Arkansas Studies Institute, which was a rebuild of some old buildings and an addition on the new building. I came to appreciate Reese's his skill, his patience, and his willingness to listen and to kind of understand what you're trying to do.
How did you settle on the design?
That's an interesting process. I've got about four different sets of drawings that led to that particular building. You start out basically by saying, here's what we want to do in it, and here's how much space this is going to take. And you think of them as boxes. And then from that, you begin to refine that out. And the architect really has to walk you through that process. And I really think even the best architect, if you can't tell them what you're going to do in the building, you're not going to get a very good building. The owner of the building or who's going to be in it has to be able to say, this is how the library operates. And then a good architect can translate that into reality. And what they can do that I don't do very well, but the architect can look at it, almost look at it in their mind and tell you what it's going to be.
So when you actually saw it, what was your reaction?
I like the look of it. I thought it was going to be a practical building for us because it's a big open space. What I wasn't sure of is how the building would sit on the property. And that's a big issue. I've seen wonderful buildings built on pieces of property that don't fit together. That one, when you drive on the property and you walk out on it, if your building actually sits in a bowl, we were able by doing that to capture all the runoff water from the interstate, and it's a natural funnel through there. So we were able to entrap that water and pound it, build a set of weir dams to hold it, and create a wetlands to go with it. And so the building is sitting right up on those wetlands, and mm-hmm. it sits in that property well. And that's a real knack for an architect to do. I've looked at it from every different angle. I've walked every foot of it, and everywhere you turn on it, you think the proportions are right. It settles on the property right. It looks like it's in the ground the way it should be. And that's kind of a magic that I think that it takes the architect to do.
That was Bobby Roberts, director of the Central Arkansas Library System. He and the architect, Reese Rowland, of Polk Stanley Wilcox Architects, are speakers on the next Architecture and Design Network event. Cal's Children's Library and Learning Center, A New Paradigm. Tuesday, May the 14th at 6 p.m. with a 5:30 reception at the Children's Library, 4800 West 10th Street, Little Rock.
Here's a look at what's happening in the arts in Arkansas. Today's the last performances for several shows across the state. At the Arkansas Rep, Death of a Salesman has two final performances at 2 and 7 today. At the Arkansas Art Center's Children's Theater, James and the Giant Peach wraps up with a final performance at 2. The Arkansas Symphony has its final performance of Cirque de la Symphony this afternoon at 3 at Robinson Center Music Hall. And Theater Squared in Fayetteville presents the final performances of Next to Normal at the Walton Art Center's Nadine Baum Studios at 2 and 7 today. Next weekend, the Arkansas Festival Ballet presents The Adventures of Pinocchio, a full-length story ballet, Friday at 7:30, Saturday at 2 and 7:30, and Sunday at 2 at the Arkansas Art Center's Children's Theater. On display around Central Arkansas, at the Thea Center in North Little Rock, Marianne Stafford's The Argenta Project. At Historic Arkansas Museum, The Curious World of Patent Models. At the Clinton Presidential Center, Jazz Through the Eyes of Herman Leonard. At the Arkansas Studies Institute, the Arkansas Arts Educators State Youth Art Show 2013. And at the Arkansas Arts Center, a Jewelry Instructors Exhibition at the Museum School Gallery. And that's a look at the arts calendar for this week. For more on what's going on in Arkansas, visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org.
In January this year, the Arkansas Symphony announced a new series, the Stella Boyle Smith, Inc., Intimate Neighborhood Concerts. Three in all in neighborhood churches, smaller, indeed intimate, relaxed, friendly, informal, mingling musicians and audience before the program started, at intermission, and afterward, but intense and closely connected, each with the other, in a manner not possible in larger concert halls. The third concert on May the 16th closes the series, where the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra and the Arkansas Chamber Singers unite in a performance of Mozart's Requiem. Philip Mann, music director-conductor of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, and John Irwin, music director of the Arkansas Chamber Singers, are my guests to describe the partnership. And Philip starts by explaining how he planned the series as a whole.
I had many different programs in mind for a series that I thought could really offer something exquisite and unique to our audiences that would last over multiple years and seasons. But it was very important to me from the very beginning that the first season made sense as a unit, that each program accomplished something separate from the others, and that if someone were to have gone through the experience of attending all three programs, that they would be left with three distinct memories and three distinct new reasons to come back to the symphony. So you saw that with that very festive opening and then a very intimate second program with just strings. And in this third program, we wanted to accomplish several things. The first is to do another major masterpiece of the repertoire, a masterpiece that wouldn't necessarily be fully realized in its sense of impact on the audience in the Robinson, in an intimate, beautiful acoustic. But also for me, I wanted to establish again the importance of oratorio and vocal repertory with a symphony orchestra. And a tertiary goal of mine that's been, we've recognized that across the last few seasons, is that we're looking for opportunities to collaborate with other Arkansas-based arts organizations. And in this case, it seemed like a perfect opportunity to do one of the great oratorio pieces of the repertoire, one of the great requiems ever written, to work in collaboration with the Arkansas Chamber Singers, already a very well-established and respected organization here in the state.
So when you reached that stage, had you just been in touch with John and chosen the Mozart, or chosen the Mozart and then reached out to John, or what?
I will shamelessly admit that, you know, I wanted the first collaboration to be really, really successful. And that's one of the reasons why we were doing the Mozart Requiem. Of course, when I reached out to John, he actually had other plans to do the Mozart Requiem. John and the organization were so gracious.
How did the singers react when you brought it up to them that you were going to be doing something extra outside the actual Chamber Singers series?
They were ecstatic. They were elated beyond belief. And the fact that we do our normal programming for the year is three concerts. But this fourth one, they were all on board. It was a very enthusiastic reception.
Then did you collaborate about the soloists that you're bringing in for this?
We've actually talked about it quite a bit, but we ended up going with four real up-and-coming young talents that are starting to distinguish themselves across opera stages around the world right now. People that are looking for experiences to expand their repertory and also build new connections with audiences and new orchestra. What people will experience in this program, they'll see Arkansas represented in their musicians in the orchestra, in the Arkansas Chamber Singers, and then to hear this young kind of burgeoning talent, it'll be quite exceptional.
Well, Drew Irvin was saying that Chauncey Packer played the Christmas Pops, was it, the Holiday Pops?
He sang in our American Songbook program.
Okay, and he said he's a phenomenal voice.
He brought the house down with a soliloquy from Carousel, and just some of his excerpts from Porgy and Bess just blew the roof off.
Do you know the singers that are listed?
No, I don't. I'm actually looking forward to hearing them.
Crystal Gerald has also appeared with the symphony on our pop series in the past. We're happy to be having the Arkansas Symphony debuts of Anna Belaya, who is a young Ukrainian soprano working right now in Los Angeles, kind of doing young artist programs and starting to kind of emerge onto the world opera stage. And then Benjamin Bloomfield is a phenomenal bass that Tatiana actually had the opportunity to work with at Tanglewood, and we've been following his career and development, and this seemed like a great opportunity. Yeah. You know, we haven't talked about the Mozart yet, but if there's anything close to an aria in the Mozart, it's the Tuba Mirum. So very excited about having Benjamin for that.
Yeah. So to talk about the Mozart, yes. How big is the orchestra for this? Is it in the closely knit, not so many things but strings that is more associated with a major choral work in the 18th century?
It's actually an interesting orchestration because you don't have a full classical wind section. You just have two basset horns, and we will be playing them on basset horn. People will recognize that as a slightly different colored sound than a clarinet, and then two bassoons. But in addition to that, you have trumpets and then three trombones. Solo trombone parts, indeed. Most of the time, they double the voices in the winds, but they're actually also offered as solo voices in the tuba mirum solo with the bass.
I was just thinking, because during the 19th century, the orchestras grew exponentially when they were accompanying choral works like Messiah. Mm-hmm. And I can remember when, I think it was Toscanini, who cut back to the Mozart side, to the Handel-sized orchestra. And it shook everybody because they'd got so used to hearing the massive orchestral sound along with huge choirs. Mm-hmm. And he suddenly brought it down to the size the composer had intended it for. And of course, since then, that's been much more the case.
I think, indeed, the history of the Mozart Requiem, it has been expanded out into massive-sized orchestras. You think of performances at the Proms mm-hmm. in London with 100 musicians just in the orchestra. But I think for me, and perhaps you might echo this, I'm not sure, John, that the grit and fire and effect is so much, it's multiplied to greater effect in smaller numbers when you can have 6 first violins playing with fire and virtuosity like you'd see in Salzburg, as opposed to a sea of violins, and you lose the grit in that front edge of the texture. There were many requiems written for princes and kings all the way from the early 17th century, but we don't play almost any of them. Even the early music movement that we've experienced in the last 25 years hasn't brought many of them back. There's something truly exceptional about Mozart's Requiem, that it's been enduring and that popular for its whole history.
Have you done it before with the singers?
Yes, we have done it on a couple of occasions before. And I agree with Philip totally. The size of the orchestra is much more, it's beneficial to the text, it's beneficial to the singers for it to be not a huge orchestra. Actually, what happened in the Romantic time, I think, actually defeated to a certain extent the meaning of the and the intimacy of that Mozart Requiem. When I was in graduate school, we referred to the 4 great requiems, but there are numerous requiems throughout time. But the Mozart, the Brahms, the Verdi, and the Fauré. We just did the Durufle Requiem, which I actually put above the Fauré. But talk about requiems, those are the 4 that are usually mentioned as the outstanding mm-hmm. requiems. So, but they're totally different orchestras for each one of them. And this text, which is Mass for the Dead, is so intimate, and it really does require that kind of almost chamber setting. And I think this, at least we hope that this will be the case for this performance.
Yes. And when you did it in a church too, or did you
yes,
do it at
Yes, we did. UCLA? I'm trying to think what church. It may have been St. James United Methodist yeah. that we did it.
Because the first United Methodist is more the Calvinistic pattern of sanctuary, isn't it? With the sort of horseshoe
yes.
rather than the nave and the apse.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
But in this setting, the experience is going to be quite different, isn't it, Philip, from the ones you've had? The 2 that you've had already have been traditional churches.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think our audiences will have recognized that in many ways the repertoire heard in these performances was in some ways inspired by the spaces themselves.
Do you agree with that?
For the most part, one thing about the Mozart that I find telling, particularly in the beginning and up to through the sequence, the Dies Irae, it just overwhelmingly eerie and frightening, the Dies Irae, quite frankly, particularly with the violin part that dances around the text. But the Lacrimosa, somewhat hopeful, and so I think there is a bit of a tinge that there is that what is beyond there is hope. The Requiem Mass. The composers all chose certain parts of the text that they would really underscore and spend more time developing. And I think Mozart, he is in tune with his operatic self because he, near the end of his life, wrote so many wonderful operas.
I think as a musician, I personally find the hope in what is truly sublimely beautiful music. I mean, and John's right that during the Lacrimosa, that's when it really, the skies start to open up a little bit. That's when Mozart died, was during his writing of the Lacrimosa. So, we have the beginning and in the first segments were all even orchestrated by Mozart, but the entire sequence was only in the figured bass and vocal parts.
Right.
So Zusmeier is in full force from the second half of the Lacrimosa on, but you can imagine Mozart sitting in his bed and dictating this just sublime beauty of the vocal writing in these final movements. And I don't mean to overstate that there's no peace to be found in the Mozart. It just doesn't seem to be its overwhelming sense of purpose. That the peace that we would find, that I personally find, is in the beauty of the music, that there must be something hopeful to look forward to if a man was able to create such extraordinary writing.
The opening Kyrie and Introit, that's the only actually totally Mozart movement.
Right.
Quite a bit of the vocal things afterwards, and the orchestration was oftentimes filled in then by Süssmayr. But what he does is Süssmayr took that Kyrie from the beginning, and used it in the ending. And so we get Mozart in the beginning, we get Mozart in the end. Quite frankly, that opening and the closing are the most genius-filled moments in the Mozart. As far as where I'm concerned, that double fugue is just blows me away every time.
Now, how many movements did he leave with very little except notes, as you might say?
Well, everything after the sequence, basically.
Yeah. What happened was he wrote the vocal parts for about the first eight movements, but only figured bass and no orchestration except for the first eight bars of the Lacrimosa. And then Süssmayr had to interpret that. And and of course, there's thought that he had some of Mozart's sketches for orchestration as well, but they've since been lost. So it's uncertain how much of it's his, how much of it is Mozart's. But you can usually tell near the end, the last few movements that are strictly Süssmayr, you can tell. It's not quite.
So that when
level.
You get the final one with the repeat, as it were, of the Mozart's,
it's fortuitous that he put the original Mozart music at the end.
Much of Mozart's genius, I think, comes through in the economy of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And the second you realize that maybe there are one or two notes that didn't have to be there, you know Süssmayr's there. But it's still extraordinary.
Yeah. What time are you going to have to rehearse if these soloists are coming in from out of state?
Well, we start working with the chorus this week, and then the following week I'll have the opportunity just to work with piano and soloists, and then we'll collect the orchestra, put the chorus together, and we should be in pretty good shape by Thursday night at 7.
It sounds wonderful. Yes. The 16th.
One thing I'd like to add, mm-hmm. Anne, is that I hope that space will be filled for the Mozart Requiem, because I think it's important that people realize that the great symphony that we have here, we never really hear it totally in Robinson. And I know I'm beating this drum a lot lately, but the fact is that that music that they make, we only get a portion of it in the room in Robinson. We should get pretty much all of it in the space at First Methodist, and that will fill the that should give goosebumps and memories to last forever if everybody comes with the idea that they want to hear what it really sounds like. And I think it will be terrific that we're doing it in these small spaces.
John Irwin, music director of the Arkansas Chamber Singers, and Philip Mann, music director-conductor of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, partners in a performance of Mozart's Requiem, the third and last in the Stella Ballsmith Intimate Neighborhood Concert Series, May the 16th at 7 p.m. in First United Methodist Church in Little Rock. For tickets, call 666-1761 or online www.arkansassymphony.org. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.